This week on Upfront, tens of thousands protest across France against a new law that would restrict sharing images of the police. Are civil liberties under threat? That is our debate. But first, after decades of violence, a major breakthrough between Afghanistan's government and the Taliban. The two sides have reached a deal to begin talks. Could peace finally be possible? Just hours before the news broke, I spoke to one of the government's only women negotiators, Fawzia Koofi, an Afghan political veteran and nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, who some say could one day become the country's first female president. Fawzia Koofi, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. There have been two attempts on your life, Fawzia, the most recent by unknown shooters, but the first by the Taliban, and your daughter witnessed both of those attacks. U.S. Envoy Zamel Khalilzad says this latest attack was meant to derail the talks. How much faith do you have that the Taliban will uphold their word in any sort of agreement that is reached?
You're right. It's very, very early to say that the Taliban have actually changed their views and perception towards some of the realities of Afghanistan, in particular towards women and especially vocal women. But in the meantime, I know that the Taliban are not, unfortunately, the only group that contribute to violence. There are ISIS in Afghanistan or Daesh or other groups, military extremist groups. In talking with Taliban, what we are trying to do is at least minimize the level of risk that Afghanistan is facing, not only in terms of the number of people that are losing lives, but the opportunities that are being taken away from that country. Afghanistan is naturally and traditionally a very rich country, billions of dollars underground. We could be a potential economical hub between South and Central Asia, but due to the war, that has not been used. So, yes, personal sacrifices is part of this process. We have to really put ourselves into a situation to feel every victim of this war. We have victims of war in the negotiation table, and as you rightly have said, I have been personally attacked twice, in the last one injured. There are others who actually lost members of family due to the war or in the war. I have lost members of family. But let's think about thousands and millions of those people back home who, in a way or the other, are victims of war. And in order to put a dignified end to this bloodshed, we would like to, with a willingness, talk with Taliban. I hope Taliban will take our willingness for talks in a good will and equally put some sincerity and genuinity into ending this war.
You talked about the fact that the Taliban is not the only group responsible for the violence in Afghanistan. Obviously, that is correct. Is another part of the problem that even if you do get an agreement with the Taliban, the threat from groups like ISIL remains? It was just last month that ISIL claimed responsibility for that attack at Kabul University that killed more than 19 people. So even if you deal with the Taliban, there's still other groups that have to be dealt with.
As I said before, with certainly Taliban are the major kind of military extremist groups which have committed, fighting and not only in the villages but also in the big cities. And kind of the attention of the government and our institutions are now shifted towards fighting with Taliban. So if we agree with Taliban on agreeing that that we could have enormously political differences, but let's live under one umbrella or at least in the same country. And then I think that will empower our institutions to be able to deal with other vulnerabilities, in this case, ISIS and or other military extremist groups that operates in the region.
Let's talk about the U.S. Of course, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan back in 2001. The American public is losing patience with fighting wars abroad. President Trump also appears to be bent on bringing troops home at any cost. He has been willing to make concessions to the Taliban, and there are reports that the U.S. has been pressuring your government to do the same. Do you think the U.S. is really invested in a peace agreement, or is it more that Trump just wants to get out and cut the U.S. losses?
The ideal agreement would have been if the negotiations between United States Taliban and Taliban with the delegation from Republic of Afghanistan or Islamic Republic of Afghanistan would have started at the same time, which was almost 2 years back. That would give the delegation of Republic a better position for bargaining. But in the meantime, we hope that there is no rush in terms of withdrawing troops under the circumstances that withdrawal is an issue, but on the basis of a condition reality in Afghanistan. This is something that has been also stated in the U.S.-Taliban agreement, that the withdrawal will be based on the condition on the ground. But in reality, we know that there will be major reduction up to 15 January. Our hope is that the new administration will clarify more in terms of, how are they going to deal with the situation of their troops in Afghanistan, because the presence of the troops actually singles out or gave a single message, which Afghanistan, which is an important geographical location and could be potentially a risk for the world if things go wrong, as it did in 2001, will not once again be abandoned in a way that it says once again a challenge for the world, a security challenge. So therefore, we hope that things will move on or shape itself in a situation where the neighboring countries, the regional countries, or those who are having an eye on the situation to reshape their politics will not use this vulnerability.
What do you say to those who claim that if U.S. troops withdraw, your government will simply collapse?
I hope that the withdrawal will be responsible and not in a way that it result in collapse of the institutions, because we know from 1992 when the Soviet troops withdraw from Afghanistan, in 1992, a collapse of the institution occurred. So we know that many countries are willing to watch the situation and see how they can actually influence. So we know that the immediate withdrawal without any tangible progress in terms of peace and agreeing on a political settlement will certainly deteriorate situation in a way that will benefit only military extremist groups, not people of Afghanistan.
You've talked a bit about the resources of your country and the location. I want to talk a little bit more about that, because isn't a problem that even in a perfect world, if the United States withdraws all troops and peace is restored in Afghanistan, that might open the door wide for Russia, China, and Iran. And given the location and abundance of natural resources for your country, are you worried that your country is simply in a vulnerable spot to have foreign influence and therefore instability?
The location of Afghanistan, time and again, has been used throughout the late history of Afghanistan against Afghanistan, unfortunately. We would like to keep a good relationship, a bilateral relationship of economic exchange, of resources exchange, of using Afghanistan connectivity capacities. But in the meantime, we understand that if there is no defined relationship between Afghanistan and its neighbor in the region, its neighbors in the region, Afghanistan could become a proxy battlefield. And therefore, I think it's important that we continue to restore peace and strengthen our institutions and then keep our ties with the rest of the world.
For decades, you have been a champion of women's rights, risking your own life to improve the lives of Afghan women and strengthen your country's democracy as well, something that earned you a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize. But when you look back at all the ways that the Taliban has oppressed women, oftentimes violently, did you ever imagine that you would end up at the same table as them negotiating your country's future?
20 years back, certainly not. Certainly not, because I lived all my life in Afghanistan, including during Taliban. And during the civil war. And I know I have seen people losing lives in front of my eyes. I have seen how women were treated, beaten up, whipped in front of my eyes. I have seen and experienced that life of brutality. So to come to the situation where now we are equal rights holder citizens, sitting across the table talking about the same country and the same interest with very diverse and different views, I think it's a step forward and it's a great achievement. And the major part of that achievement, the credit actually goes to the resilience and strength of the women of Afghanistan, because the life for women of Afghanistan, regardless of where they work, which position they hold or they are at home, is not an easy life. And even to be in the negotiation table was not easy. To be part of the negotiation is another level of women rights, expressing the woman power or strength, because you really have to have shoulder to face some of those challenges. So it is a very challenging life, but the only hope or the only time we get a positive vibe to continue the extremely challenging job we have is the fact that we think of the moments where we could sit in a car in Afghanistan and drive across Afghanistan, enjoy the beauty without the fear of, you know, being shot, as I was during August, or being, you know, a fear of being whipped or hit for your gender, or even for our male part, citizens of the society. That is the hope that actually keeps us moving. Something that we are deprived. We are deprived of see the beauty seeing the beauty of our country now.
There's speculation over the years that you might become the first female president of your country. You did run back in 2014. Do you think that you'll run again one day?
Well, I always hope that Afghanistan, in order to demonstrate a different image of what it has in reality in different layers of the society, is to be hopefully one day led by a woman. Because, if you look at around in our neighboring countries, you have, women leaders in Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, although India is a different experience or example, but in the Muslim countries, you had women in the leadership position. Now, I know it is a very extremely difficult path to get there. I know my challenges. But in the meantime, during the time I have been in politics, along with my other fellow sisters, we have really tried to demonstrate passion, honesty, commitment, and under no circumstances that has changed, actually. No difficulty or no challenge has actually shifted our focus in terms of loving our country and our people and trying to deliver. And that is actually understood and appreciated by people back home. Now, in the male-dominated political system of Afghanistan, it will be very difficult to get to that level, but that is the ultimate goal.
Fawzia Koofi, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Thank you.
More than 100,000 people demonstrated in France this past weekend to protest a security bill that, among other things, banned sharing images that make police officers identifiable. Protesters and activists say the law would infringe upon civil liberties and worry it's just the latest move by President Emmanuel Macron to a more authoritarian leadership style. According to Human Rights Watch, the bill could, quote, seriously limit the ability of the media and ordinary citizens to document law enforcement abuses. Critics worry that would mean police were not being held accountable for acts of brutality, such as the beating of a black music producer. Videos of that beating went viral last week. Macron's government now says it's reviewing the legislation. The questions still remain about the intent and potential impact of such laws. Joining me to discuss this are Roland Lescure, a member of parliament and spokesperson for President Macron's ruling party, La République en Marche, and Cécile Coudrieu, the president of Amnesty International in France. Thank you both for joining me in the arena. Cécile, I want to start with you. Your organization has said that France is not the free speech champion it says it is, and that the French government's rhetoric on free speech is shamelessly hypocritical. Now, even before the government tried to push out this law, thousands of people had already been convicted for contempt of public officials, basically this vaguely worded offense. It's meant to silence or at least dampen dissent somewhat. The French government has also moved to dissolve an NGO that works on anti-racism issues, something Amnesty has expressed concern about, both in terms of this particular organization and just the chilling effect this can have on other NGOs. This is the type of stuff you hear about in dictatorships. How worried are you about what we're seeing in France?
Well, I think it's a bad sign that we are using this kind of language about France, indeed. But as you know, our constant reference being international law, we have to have the same recommendations and the same positions about France, just like about any other country. So, of course, we have expressed very serious concerns about this global security bill. But at the same time, we are making recommendations to make sure that our call upon the government to be more respectful of France's commitments to respect human rights will be heard. So I have to confess, we have a kind of frustration at the moment, because for quite some time now, we have sent warnings, alerts, and also recommendations. We have been auditioned, but apparently we haven't been heard, because we still consider that some fundamental freedoms, such as freedom of expression, freedom to inform, but also freedom from surveillance, because in that bill there are also a few issues about, you know, the right to privacy. So that's why we think there is a wider and wider gap between what the President Emmanuel Macron says and declares and the actual policy which is implemented, or some bills that are proposed by the majority in France. We have to make sure that policies are in conformity with France's commitment to respect international law related to human rights.
So, Orlane, you've heard the concerns that Cecile and her organization have. Your government, though, has said that this law is necessary to protect police officers from threats and attacks. But I'm sure you cannot deny there are people in France that are concerned about being on the receiving end of police violence or police brutality. And they fear this law would essentially provide cover for police officers who abuse their positions of power. In just this past week, Roland, the nation was shocked by footage of police officers brutally beating a black music producer, Michel Zecler. The officers have been charged with assault. They are under investigation. That is true. But only because this video went viral. If this law you've been pushing were in effect, there would have been no video for people to see. There would have been no accountability. Isn't that true?
No, of course, if that law had been passed, those images would have been available, they would have been shot, they would have been on air, and they would have been leading to what happened, which is not only those officers have been suspended, they're under investigation, and two of them are currently in jail. There has been some understanding about the law we're trying to vote, and therefore we've decided to go back on the drawing board on that front. But what we're trying to prevent is police officers being threatened, being named and shamed, giving their address, so that they may be the victim of personal offenses themselves because their name is being put in the public on the social network. But in no way were we planning to prevent anyone from filming or putting those images on air of any actions, including the one from the police. I understand that there's been some misunderstanding. We haven't been clear in the way we presented that article about that law, and therefore we've taken it back and we're going to draw it again. I mean, there are counterpowers in France, and we've seen it, you know, on Saturday there was a massive demonstration in France, hundreds of thousands of people who suddenly had misunderstood, or at least understood, the fact that our law may prevent the liberty of informing, and this is the reason why we took it out. There are three issues now in France. There are worries, and Amnesty International has raised some of them, about the liberty to inform, and this we need to reassure of. There are police violences that has been seen, including against Michel Zecler, and you've seen it, and we need to address that. Like any police force in the world, they have to be irreproachable, and they can't get away with what we saw last week. But three, there's also been very violent demonstrators, not very many of them, but that have not demonstrating for freedom of speech. They haven't demonstrated for anything
those
else
are, those are,
than
Roland,
attacking the police.
I'm going to have Cecile interact with you. Cecile, go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to jump in if possible, because I think there is a kind of general drift, which is particularly alarming, is this tendency to rely much more on suspicion and interpretation of a potential intention rather than facts. So, for example, about the associations, when we said something about that, it was not particularly to defend this or that organization. It was much more in the general principle to remind the government that to dissolve an association is a very serious issue. It means it has to be based on facts and not on suspicion, that in the name of security, sometimes freedom, fundamental freedoms are threatened because it becomes a kind of priority, if you like, security, to the detriment of other liberties. So we think that every government, including the French government, when they prepare law, first of all, they should have in mind their own commitments to respect principles such as legality, which means that the law should be written properly. It was certainly not the case. It is not the case with Article 24, but I repeat, also 22 about the use of drones. There is still no legal frame about surveillance. It is particularly alarming. And in the case of associations, it is the same. We can understand that if there is a real incitement to hate, to act, you know, in a criminal way, of course, it should be punished. It could be a good reason for a dissolution. But we shouldn't drift away from human rights okay. in the name of security. That's the main argument every time.
So,
and yeah.
Cecile, just a moment. I want to put this to Roland. When we talk about incentivizing violence or protecting police from violent fringe groups, Roland, there are already laws in place that do that, aren't there?
Exactly.
Yeah, and there's just there is a gap that has been seen and identified by legal specialists around what happens on social networks. Those laws that you're alluding to were drafted and voted years ago, and therefore we felt there was a gap. But I'll give Cecile one point. That article was badly written. We're going to rewrite it because there was an ambiguity in what she just said. The intent was not well qualified. But on the association, I can tell you, there's been a lot of questions around some NGOs that are not NGOs, that are actually political organizations, that are preaching discourses, speeches, and action that are not consistent with the French laws, with the French values, with the French constitution, actually. And it's very hard to close them. I can tell you, there's been a lot of work to prove that point. And again, a judge is going to be able to assess that if those NGOs are questioning the decision, which I believe they haven't done yet. But I don't want to, you know, your viewers to feel that this is France drifting to, you mentioned it, dictatorial measures, because suddenly all these measures have been voted by an elected parliament. I'm one of them. There is a constitutional court in France that's completely independent and that's going to look at these laws and reassure the people on the fact that they are constitutional.
Okay.
And we have decided, again, I'm giving Cecile that point, that article had to be redrafted because we want to protect the police officers, but we certainly don't want any liberty to inform to be impeded.
Cecile, I do want to ask you that about something that Roland has mentioned. The government has said that they are reviewing the law, and the prime minister announced there's going to be an independent commission to look into it. Does that satisfy you at all?
Well, not really. I think the whole process is flawed. From the beginning, it was quite strange to have a bill presented by members of parliament. But then at the last minute, articles that were the most dangerous for freedom of speech and, I repeat, freedom to the right of privacy as well, were introduced. And nobody can be naive. It was by the government, obviously. And some articles like this should be really debated in depth. And it was an accelerated process. Procedure, you know, just a few days in the National Assembly to discuss such serious issues, I think that France really deserves better. And I'm afraid that, again, this question of freedom for journalists is a kind of smokescreen, because, number one, it is also for citizens, not only for journalists, that there should be a right to film, disseminate the images and document potential violations of human rights by police officers. Amnesty International has used a lot of these videos in a lot of different kinds of research to write reports and to try to ask for accountability. Because to me, the main threat on the police today is certainly not social networks. It is this feeling that there is an impunity when some policemen have, you know, really terrible attitude, either racist or an excessive use of force, for example. And this sense of impunity is also destroying what is absolutely essential in rule of law, I mean, the trust between the population and the police.
That will be the final word. Thank you both for the discussion. Roland Lescure, Cécile Quadrio, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That is our show for now. Up Front, we'll be back next week.